This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And today we're going to start our show with an interesting story that relates to history and to philosophy and the way we wrestle with, well, things that happened a long time ago that we need to remember. And matter of fact, never forget was a phrase that probably refers to this. Jack Russell Weinstein joins us by phone from Bemidji. He is the host of Public Radio's Why, Philosophical Discussions about Everyday Life, which you can hear on Prairie Public, and that's Sundays at 5 p.m. Central, right here where you're listening now. But Jack, the reason we've got you on the phone from Bemidji is, well, what brought you there? Tell our listeners why you're there.
Well, I worked on a panel yesterday for the Why radio show, which unfortunately is not going to broadcast, on Concordia's language camps. Waldsee is a German immersion camp that's been around since 1961. It's the best of the world, pretty much, which is nice to have in our region. And they discovered recently that their name, Waldsee, is associated with a pretty horrible thing that happened during the Holocaust. And they had to ask themselves, were they going to change their name? Were they glorifying this event? Were they memorializing this event? And so they got together a bunch of people, including myself, to have conversations about how to resolve a serious and real moral dilemma.
Well, Waldsee in German means forest lake. That's a descriptive name for where the camp is actually located near Bemidji. Tell us about how you're wrestling with this.
Well, first of all, everyone in this area will recognize why this is important. You can translate it as Forest Lake. You can also translate it as Lake of the Woods. And all of the language camps in the area, or almost all of them, they have a French camp, they have an Italian camp, are some version of Lake of the Woods. Lac de Bois is the French camp, for example. And so what they wanted to do was have a connection to the area as well as this connection to Waldsee. But here's what it turned out happened. Hungarian and Polish Jews who were sent to Auschwitz, when they were first arrived, they were given postcards to send out. And these were not picture postcards like we have now. These are very efficient, one-sided, I think, dark green postcards. And they were ordered to write, "We're having a great time. We're on our way to Waldsee. Wish you were here." It's a, and then to sign it and send it out to their relatives. The folks at Auschwitz then covered the postmark that said Auschwitz to Waldsee. Now, they didn't know what Waldsee was. No one knew what Waldsee was. Some of them could write in Yiddish on the side, "This is a trap, they're lying," but many of them didn't have the courage to do so or didn't understand what was going on. And so the name Waldsee was used to hide the fact that these folks were going to be exterminated, which they were shortly after they wrote the postcards. Now, Waldsee, German language village, is a summer camp, and the kids write postcards. And the kids write, you know, "Wish you were here." And so there's this both analogous situation, which is benign or kind of cute in the summer camp situation, but it evokes this horrendous story that actually not a lot of people know.
Well, this horrific story takes place 70 years ago. When did the people who run the camp learn about this connection?
They learned about it in May. Actually, a parent who was associated with one of the other camps contacted them and wrote them. Now, they're a little embarrassed because some of them are historians and very well-regarded scholars of German history, but this is just a little-known thing. But they took it so seriously that immediately they created a plan to address it. The summer sessions were just about to begin. They couldn't change the name. They couldn't do anything in that short time. So they got together a group of people. There's someone from the German embassy. There's someone from education in the U.S. Holocaust Museum. There's a bunch of German scholars, both regional and then alumni who work in the area from the German language village, and I myself was invited in part because of my background with public philosophy and in part because my daughter has been going to the camp for, this is her seventh year, and so I was very interested as well for personal as well as professional reasons. And what they decided to do, which was incredibly interesting, was make it public. They sent out an email immediately to all of their constituents, and they told them what was going on, and they told them the plan, and they asked for comments. And people wrote, I think, 40 pages worth of comments via email. The dean of the camp, Dan Hamilton, contacted the mayors of both existing cities named Waldsee in Germany. They've started this very open process to ask people what to do, and this summer is the time that they've given to talking, reflecting, thinking about ideas, and coming to a decision.
So this is a teachable moment.
This is a teachable moment. It's also, for lack of a better phrase, a learnable moment. I knew about the name. It had been a discussion in my family. My daughter wasn't bothered by it at all. Of course, she's 12. My mother, who was of the generation of children of Holocaust survivors, was very upset by the use of the name, and so there was some disagreement there, and I, you know, assumed that the camp knew and that they had made their decision. So, but for me, especially, being part of this group of very interested people who are genuinely interested in solving a problem, I learned about the issue, I learned more about the Holocaust, but I also learned about the process of deliberation and teaching in a camp setting and what it means to have responsibilities to these two groups. You have a responsibility towards the victims who have no voice, but you also have a responsibility towards the campers, the students and their family and the staff, all of who pay to go to the camp, make a living at the camp. And so whatever Waldsee is going to do in the end is going to model this behavior for future circumstances.
Well, Jack Russell Weinstein is the host of Public Radio's Why, Philosophical Discussions about Everyday Life. He's in Bemidji talking about the Waldsee, the Concordia Language Village immersive German camp. And Jack, I did a little research, and I discovered that in 2004, there was the discovery of these postcards had been established, and an exhibit was put together. I was intrigued when you said that in your family this discussion had been something that had happened previously. So how long have you known about Waldsee, you yourself?
I don't know the answer to that because I don't remember learning it. I just kind of knew it the way these things are, but it's been a few years. And so I suspect what happened is that my mother came across it and sparked the conversation, but it's and we didn't have that conversation when my daughter started when she was 6 years old. You know, as a Jewish family, which we are, there are people who raise their eyebrows because our daughter is going to a German camp, period. There is a generation of people who distrust Germany, period, and who are very, very suspicious. They don't want to have a Volkswagen car. They don't want to have BMW because, of course, both of those companies started with slave labor from the camps. I'm not of that generation. I lived in Vienna, Austria for a few years. I can speak German, albeit inexpertly, and it was important to me that Adina had that connection. So already there was this decision to push away this resistance towards the German culture. Coming to the group discussion, there was no resistance amongst the participants about Jewish people associating with Germany or being part of the Jewish culture, because, of course, Jewish culture has always been a part of the German culture. That's been part of the Holocaust discussion, that the Jews of the early 20th century considered themselves German. And when the Holocaust happened, one of the things that was foisted upon them was this assertion that you aren't German, you are Jewish. And so coming into a group of people who didn't question Jewish participation in German life allowed us to have a different conversation. That was really just the value of memorials, the value of recognizing this name. Is it an insult to have the name? And then there was a different conversation that was an underpinning of all, which is, do you trust the camp? Meaning Waldsee, the language village. Do you trust the folks at Waldsee? And I will say, as someone who's been in a lot of controversial conversations, watching them engage in this process, I have only grown to trust them more. I trust the decision they're going to make because I trust the process that they're engaged in. And I've really seen how genuinely concerned they are. And that's why I wanted to participate both in the group and bring it to the radio audience, because I think it's fascinating and it's a really good model of a really good discussion.
Well, you've touched on this a bit, but what are the philosophical issues that will be wrestled with here?
Well, the first is, to what extent does a name like Valtse carry its history, right? We all have names. We are named often after our relatives, or we're named after objects. There's a generation of kids named Espen who are named after a sports network, right?
Yes.
Names matter to us. And so if the camp is named Valtse, does that mean that the Concordia folks are endorsing what's happening at the Holocaust? Of course, they're not, and it doesn't mean that, but it can be perceived that way. The other set of questions is, how do you memorialize people without, and this is my term, not the camps, without making it pornographic, without taking a pleasure or an extreme version of something in order to make a point? This is complicated by the fact that this is a summer camp, and the campers want to have fun and they want to enjoy themselves, and German language learning and German culture learning has to be fun in order for them to go. And so you don't want this monolithic, dark, heavy memorial in the middle of the camp where all the kids are running and playing and having a good time, and then all of a sudden, you know, incredibly depressed by coming face to face with the horrors of genocide. So how do you create a memorial that's consistent with the location? How do you create something that's age appropriate? There are campers who are 8 years old. There are campers who are 18 years old. They're not going to have the same learning experience. They're not going to have the same content. There are also just this question, which you brought up in your introduction, is what does it mean to never forget? Does it mean to acknowledge it? Does it mean to know the full story? Does it mean to give lip service to something but not really reflect on it? And of course, then there's this whole other question, which is, how do you balance business needs with moral needs, right? Valtse is a business. They have to, you know, pay their bills. And if they change their name, that's going to have an effect on their reputation. It's going to have an effect on their cost. If they don't change their name, it's going to have an effect on their reputation and their bottom line. If they address this, people are going to respond a certain way. If they don't address this, people are going to respond a certain way. So how do you balance the business needs? How do you balance the voice of the victims who have no voice? And how do you balance the needs of the campers and the staff, all of whom are paying for a service and who identify with this community? One of the amazing things about Valtse, and I suspect this is true of all of the Concordia language villages, is the campers who go through with it regard it as fundamental experiences in their upbringing, and they have incredible connections as citizens of Valtse. And so when they hear this criticism, many of them take it really personally because it is an intimate criticism that affects their identity and their self-image. And we had to respect that as well.
Well, nevertheless, Valtse was founded, as you mentioned, in 1961. And at that time, Germany was partitioned, and Berlin in particular had a wall going through it, or soon would. So the history of this language and this place is certainly a component. Is that the part that's going to be added to Valtse, the experience?
I'm trying to figure out how to answer this question properly, because they do talk about the partition quite a bit. But there's a difference between talking about the partition and talking about the Holocaust.
Oh,
because
sure.
When you talk about communism, you can do play acting, you can have simulations, is what they call them in pedagogy, in teaching theory. You can have simulations, and actually I understand from our daughter that they had one the other night. You can't have a simulation of the Holocaust. It's too disturbing, it's too upsetting, and it's too, in fact, disrespectful. This is the best practice as articulated by the pedagogy folks at the Holocaust Museum. So how do you include it in the experience? But then there's also this other question, which is, you also don't want to teach the only thing about Jews is that they're victims, and the only part of the German history is that the Jews were killed. Where did they come from before? How does Jewish food incorporate into the Valtse experience? How does Yiddish, the derivative, Yiddish is the international Jewish language that's a combination of Hebrew and German, how does that fit in? So the camp is trying to develop a sense of German history that is inclusive of the good and the bad and a holistic overview that also incorporates the more difficult experiences of Germany. And now I'll say something else that, again, is in my words rather than the camps, which is my view of the history of Germany, is it's a history of a struggle with being a struggle to be a unified culture. Gutenberg invents creates the first local language Bible, and it's in German. Before that, it was in Hebrew and Greek. By creating a German language Bible, it unifies all of German speakers in a way that they'd never been before. Then, hundreds of years later, Germany is divided by, well, first Prussia and is unified with the other areas of Germany. I don't want to go into too much detail, but then you talk about the Eastern Bloc, that's divided and then reunified again. So what does it mean to create a unified picture of history in a people who have struggled to be unified that includes the good and the bad, and how do you do it in a way that's accessible to 8-year-olds, to 18-year-olds, and doesn't take away from the fact that you're also there to swim, you're there to dance, you're there to have, campfires, and you don't want your kids to have to simulate the Holocaust in the process of learning a new language.
Jack Russell Weinstein is the host of Public Radio's Why? Philosophical Discussions about Everyday Life. And Jack, you're going to have an encore version of the show this Sunday on Prairie Public at 5 Central. It's Philosophy and Disability, and this features Anita Silvers. This originally aired in December of 2016. Just a very brief description of this discussion.
This was an incredibly interesting discussion with a woman who is a leader in the philosophy of disability movement. How do you think about disability? How do you talk about justice in terms of disability? There are connections here, of course, with philosophy and disability in the Holocaust, because disabled people were victims as well. And so I wanted to substitute something so at least we're having a version of the same conversation. Anita is a wonderful guest and really challenging and fun and the best at what she does. It's an episode that I'm particularly proud of.
It's Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why? Philosophical Discussions about Everyday Life. Thanks, Jack.
Thank you, Doug.
Coming up next on Main Street, another excerpt from the Red River Rainbow Seniors Oral History Project.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative. Touchstone Energy Cooperatives comprise a nationwide network of 750 Touchstone Cooperative consumer-owned utilities dedicated to innovation, integrity, and commitment to community. Support for Prairie Public is provided by the North Dakota Farmers Market and Growers Association, helping North Dakota farmers, ranchers, and gardeners market their products through farmers markets, grocery stores, and restaurants statewide. Learn more at ndfarmersmarkets.org.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Today we have another excerpt to share from the Red River Rainbow Seniors Oral History Project called Breaking Barriers, Harvesting LGBTQ Stories from the Northern Plains. It features stories from folks who grew up back when being out was much harder. Today's subject, whose name we've been asked not to reveal, was interviewed by project volunteer Larry Peterson, NDSU Emeritus Professor of History.
When were you first aware of your gay inclinations or identity?
It's hard to know. It came on extremely gradually, and not until I was an adult. I mean, even in college, I had no inclinations at all. I guess you could say there might have been some indication there. I had sort of a crush on one male, but I never thought of actually acting on it for quite some time.
And how did you feel about that when you first had some of those thoughts or feelings?
Maybe slightly conflicted, but not terribly. I never really acted on them until my late 50s. I don't think I would have ever divorced, if hadn't I mean, I just wouldn't have done it. My wife left me. I didn't leave her.
And your children know that you're gay?
Yes, both sons do.
And how do your children seem to feel about your relationship?
Well, the older one seems to be okay with it. In fact, we had a talk once, and I asked him, well, what would you think if I got married? It wouldn't bother him. Whereas the younger son, he and I sort of had it out in an email once. What bothered him most was that, you know, according to him, I broke up the family and I hadn't ever apologized for it. And I said, well, I'm sorry if I hurt you. And he said, that helps a lot. The relationship is quite cordial, but somehow there's a little bit of tension there usually, but it's a work in progress.
When you think about how being gay has changed over your lifetime in terms of how you see yourself.
Well, you know, like I said, until actually when I was in my 50s, you know, it never was a problem. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, I was sort of furtive about it, of course, and now I'm more open, but I don't flaunt it. And I have, well, let's put it this way. Until I met, and we talked about this, neither of us really had any clue that we could fall in love with a person of the same sex. It just never occurred to us. We thought these were just sort of hookups or, you know, casual stuff. But, you know, now we find out that that's very different. So that has changed my attitude quite a bit. I mean, I thought, well, you know, they should have rights just like anybody else should. So, but I must admit, it took me a little bit of time to get used to gay marriage.
At this point in your life, what's important to you?
Relationships. The most important is my relationship, but then my family comes very close thereafter, and so does his. You know, so the fact that we're both on the same page that way is, in fact, we're both on the same page 99.9% of the time.
That's a great joy.
It is. It is a great joy. We you said the right word there. I never thought that people of the same sex could truly fall in love. But, you know, what's happened is just beyond magnificent. I have never been so happy in a relationship in all my life. It's just been wonderful.
Again, that was from the Red River Rainbow Seniors Oral History Project called Breaking Barriers, Harvesting LGBTQ Stories from the Northern Plains. It featured interviewer Larry Peterson and a participant who wished to remain anonymous. Breaking Barriers stories will eventually be available from the North Dakota State University Archives. It's an ongoing project, and if you wish to get involved, you can contact Red River Rainbow Oral History at gmail.com. Meanwhile, FM Pride is underway in Fargo-Moorhead this weekend, and there's lots of information about that at fmpride.com. Coming up on Main Street, our weekly news chat with News Director Dave Thompson, and Matt Olean reviews the new movie, Eighth Grade. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Although he can't say when the Trump administration's trade war will end, Senator John Hoeven says the push is being made.
The goal is to get better trade agreements and to get them as soon as we can.
Hoeven says he was recently told by the administration that talks in renegotiating NAFTA are advancing. He says NAFTA nailed down what would be a big step in the right direction.
They think they're close to getting a deal with Mexico. They're hopeful that will put pressure on Canada to come along and that they're hopeful to get a NAFTA deal done this fall, hopefully early fall.
Hovind says the fall is also being mentioned as the time for releasing details on the president's farm relief package. He says officials with the Farm Service Agency are working hard on developing the policies for the assistance program. Hovind says while NAFTA talks and the assistance package are advancing, no timeline has been discussed in resolving talks with China. North Dakota's adult education program is looking to get funding from the state's K-12 education formula. Adult education serves mainly people between 16 and 21 who have left school without finishing and are now working toward a GED degree. It's primarily funded through a mix of state and federal money. Program Assistant Director Stanley Schauer told the legislature's Interim Education Finance Committee the program is projected to continue to grow. Schauer says students with GED degrees help the state's economy in a number of ways.
The first is the addition by subtraction. Many of our students come to us on state assistance. Our goal is to help them improve their situation and therefore removing themselves from said state assistance. The second addition is the individual is now a taxpayer and economic contributor. Estimated complete economic impact is approximately $30 million a year.
Schauer says because of budget cuts in the current biennium, the program has had to eliminate 5 to 6 satellite sites where adult education is delivered. Bismarck Senator Aaron Oban is a member of that committee.
I just think the more money we can put into people on the front end to keep them off assistance on the back end is a wise investment.
Schauer says he's working on a proposal for the 2019 legislature to consider. And this weekend, the former governor's mansion state historic site in Bismarck is hosting its annual ice cream social. As part of that, it will be a birthday party for former First Lady Grace Link, who turns 100. Site curator Jonathan Campbell.
Governor Link, as a state representative in 1959, is the one who initiated saving this building, the former governor's mansion, as a state historic site.
But Campbell says after the new governor's mansion was opened in 1960, the former mansion did not immediately become a state historic site.
Instead of becoming a historic site, it became the North Dakota Psychiatric Clinic in 1960. We had an intern a number of years ago that interviewed people that worked here. Every one of them said they were told not to alter the building because it would be a historic site one day.
After the psychiatric clinic moved out, the state health department had some offices in the building.
In 1974, it was turned over to the State Historical Society, and the Society for the Preservation of the Former Governor's Mansion was formed, and Grace Link was one of the founding members along with her husband, Art. So she has a long time, long history with the site.
The ice cream social begins at 12:30 p.m. on Sunday. North Dakota has had only 3 governor's mansions since statehood. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Well, the sound of that old wire machine in the background means it's time for a couple of old news guys to talk about the headlines that have been making news this week. Dave Thompson joins us from our newsroom in Bismarck. Hello, Dave.
Hello, Doug.
Let's start with the visit of another cabinet secretary to North Dakota,
right.
Elaine Chao, transportation secretary.
Yes, she was out. It was a forum on infrastructure sponsored by the American Conservative Union. It was held in Bismarck. And she talked about some of the projects that are going on. She did not get into a lot of details, but did talk about some things that are happening conceptually.
Well, she mentioned that the EPA is going to be rolling back those Obama-era fuel efficiency standards.
Right, and what I did not hear before is that she said there was going to be another attempt to write some new standards, and there are apparently 8 options on the table now, and they're going to kind of look at that and have something rolled out a little bit later on.
Well, in your story earlier this week, you also mentioned that she talked about working with FERC to streamline the permitting process for liquefied natural gas pipelines.
Right, and that's becoming a real issue in states like North Dakota, is we have a pipeline issue where we're running out of space, not only on liquefied natural gas, but regular natural gas and oil. We're starting to run out of space.
Okay, and she was aware of our unmanned aircraft systems testing in this state as well.
Right, and that is a big thing because, you know, the Department of Transportation at the federal level named North Dakota one of these sites for a coexisting airspace where regular airplanes and drones can coexist. It's good in North Dakota because we've got a lot of airspace.
Yes, and Grand Forks and Fargo both have airbase operations that deal with drones operating all around the globe, I guess.
Absolutely, and that it's a good place for that.
As a matter of fact, we occasionally see one of those drones flying over Fargo-Moorhead.
Oh, yes, and I think you'll see more. Okay. I think you'll see a lot more, perhaps.
Dave, also earlier this week, you had a story about the Office of Management and Budget in North Dakota talking about these strategy review meetings, because the governor has put out the word we need to think about budget trimming again. But what's the status of that?
The status of that, he's finished those, and I guess this was a new concept, is that you're trying to get together with agencies to maybe look at ways to streamline what you do and try to eliminate duplication. So Joel Morissette, the Office of Management and Budget Director, started these meetings, and he's going to try to continue them 2 years from now. And it's a good way to, as he says, help everybody prepare the executive budget, which is going to be presented to the legislature in December.
So will there be some recommendations forwarded to the legislature for people to consider?
No, I think that's where it's going to be. I don't think they can do that necessarily by fiat, but there will be some recommendations. And I do know some places where some things might be coming, and I can't say any more, because, you know, the final budget proposals are being worked on.
Late yesterday, you filed a story about some MDU natural gas customers getting some money back, perhaps.
Perhaps, and they will. But this whole thing has to be settled yet. And this is a one-year-old rate case for natural gas. They were going to raise the price of what it costs to just bring the pipe into your home before they put natural gas into it. Well, that was lowered in the interim rate, and then that was lowered further because of the effect of the tax cuts. And then what they have agreed to now is a lot lower than that. So you're figuring they're going to get a one-time bill credit. But there's an issue still out there, because MDU wants the authority to levy costs on infrastructure replacement without having to go through a full-blown rate case. That's where there is a bit of a not quite agreed to yet with the staff of the PSC. And, of course, some of the interveners don't like that yet either.
All right. Well, we know that North Dakota is a big energy-producing state, lots of oil and natural gas and coal and wind as
Absolutely.
Well. And there was a story earlier this week that Xcel is building a $200 million Foxtail wind project in southeast North Dakota.
Yeah.
Just an example of how big this is getting, because I think wind employs more people than just about anybody in
just
power.
About now, yes. And you're talking about the Foxtail project. The ground was broken this week for that, and that construction is now underway. And there are other wind farms that are still on the drawing board that have not got to the approval stage yet.
And it's a reminder, obviously, that it's an important component of our energy mix in the state. And there's going to be a renewable energy rally that will be held at the state capitol. I read in the Bismarck Tribune today, the Lakota People's Law Project and the Democratic NPL Renewable Energy Caucus are going to be doing this.
Right, and I believe that's tomorrow, and I think it's 11 o'clock, if I'm correct.
It's 1:30 to 6:15 on Sunday.
Okay.
I've got the story.
All right. I'm thinking about something else that is going to happen tomorrow, too. So
this is getting out there. I mean, people are demonstrating about the importance of renewable energy, just making sure people are aware that there is support for it.
Absolutely.
Dave, you had a story a couple days ago, or just yesterday, actually, that the cases of West Nile virus are increasing in North Dakota. That was
troublesome. A huge increase from 1 week to the next, where it went from 4 to 18 cases. And now, they test pools around the state. They have separate pools made up to find these Culex tarsalis mosquitoes. In 30 of the pools, they found those mosquitoes. Just because the mosquitoes are there doesn't mean they're carrying West Nile virus, but the Culex tarsalis mosquitoes are the ones that do carry West Nile. So it's a good reminder that we should all still be on the guard, that if you're out around dusk or dawn, you should probably wear long sleeves and long pants, or at least have bug spray with DEET in it.
Yeah, those,
to prevent the bites.
Those all-important four letters, DEET.
DEET, yes.
Okay. Dave, you also had a story yesterday that the state share of funding for local schools will drop slightly.
Yes, it was up to 80% at one time, and you and I both remember the days where it was 50-50 or less.
Mm-hmm.
The whole goal was to get to 70% at one time. Now, during the Dalrymple administration, they did get it to 80%. They wanted to get it to between 80 and 85. But because of the state's budget situation and K-12 funding was held flat but didn't increase and the number of students increased, Well, there was a little bit more dependence on property tax. That's why it's 75-25 right now. There is a real hope that they'll be able to do something bumping up state aid in the next session. But again, it's going to be another tight budget.
And as you mentioned in your story, North Dakota now spends about $2 billion over a two-year period on elementary and secondary education. So
right.
$1 billion a year, it's a big-ticket item.
It's a huge ticket item and is one of the top priorities of any legislator, no matter which party you are.
Well, let's talk about the ongoing frustration from constituents on implementing the medical marijuana law, Dave.
That came to a head in an interim committee. The person from the state health department took the brunt of it. And legislators were saying, why is it taking so long? Because we voted on this in 2016. Why is it not implemented? Well, there are lots of reasons for that, including the legislature having to redo or thinking they had to redo the bill. And then you had to get all these procedures in place, all the permits in place, get the people applying for these compassion centers in place. And it is taking a while, but the health department says they're hoping that maybe by the end of the year, the dispensaries can start dispensing medical marijuana.
You get the feeling that they may wish they hadn't set those sort of benchmarks in time about when things would get accomplished, because they clearly haven't been.
Right, and the real underlying fear among some of these people is that this is just more fuel in the fire to have recreational marijuana approved.
Yes, because it's we still haven't heard whether it's been finalized for the November ballot, but the petitions have been submitted.
Not yet. We'll hear next week, Monday.
Okay. Meanwhile, North Dakota has 19 medical marijuana dispensary applications.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that story in the forum today.
Right. You're going to cut that down to 8. Remember, the two cities have been picked for the grow centers, and that's Bismarck and Fargo. And now you have 8 that are going to be dispensaries from that. And there's a lot of interest. 19 is a pretty good number.
Okay. Well, stay tuned.
Yep.
Dave, you had a story a couple days ago. Cell phone use is banned in North Dakota state fleet vehicles. What's this about?
They did that in July as a demonstration that cell phones can equate to distracted driving, whether you're talking on your cell phone or texting on your cell phone. So they want state employees who are the state fleet users to set an example saying, okay, we're not going to allow the cell phone use in their vehicles. And from what I understand, it may even be Bluetooth. They don't want any kind of distraction. They want people to pay attention to the roadways.
So not even using that hands-free piece, huh?
That's the way I understand it.
Okay. And Information Technology Department in the state of North Dakota is working toward consolidation, Dave. What does that mean, really?
Well, you've got people who are responsible for IT in each individual department, and the plan is to try to bring that under one umbrella, ITD, maybe moving those positions over to ITD, and freeing up some of these people who are doing ITD as a part-time thing to concentrate on one job. That's the idea behind it. And they determined early on they really wanted to go ahead and do this by executive order, but they decided the legislature really has to be involved in that. The legislature is insisting on that because the legislature is the one that has the purse strings. So they're going to be coming up with proposals to do some more consolidation. And the ITD director says this will mean you're going to have a more uniform, front door into state government, that websites are going to not look as different as they do right now. You're going to have more of a consistent look across state agencies.
Well, stay tuned for that, because some departments may want to protect their
I think there's
websites.
Going to be some pushback, yes.
Okay. Dave, you said there's a bit of a surprise in the news today. What is
it? I do have a surprise. Now, are you familiar with the former governor's mansion, the historic site?
Yes, I am.
The 1883. Did you know that when the new mansion was built and was occupied in 1960, it did not become a historic site overnight? It was a clinic for mental health.
Oh.
And that was for about 3, 4, 5 years there. It was part of the Kennedy administration's proposal to put more of a focus on mental health. Then after that clinic moved out, then the health department had offices in that house for a while. And it took until 1974 until it was a full state historic site.
Well, it's always had a purpose, I guess.
It sure has.
We check in with our news director, Dave Thompson, every Friday. Dave, have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, that fanfare says it's time to talk about the latest movie with Matt O'Lean, and you went to one that's getting a lot of buzz, Matt, Eighth Grade.
Eighth Grade. It's rated R, by the way. I want to tell parents that up front in case your teenager wants to go.
Well, my eighth grade was rated R as well, so well, I remember vividly.
Yeah. So writer-director Bo Burnham, this film is now playing in wide release in Fargo. It's at Marcus and the Fargo Theater both, which is unusual. And it should be available pretty much everywhere now. This is writer-director Bo Burnham's look into the last week of eighth grade of a young girl named Kayla, played by Elsie Fisher. And this might be my favorite film of the year so far. And you might say, well, it's a teen movie. How can that be your favorite movie of the year? It is so different from other teen movies I've seen in recent years. It is so realistic, Doug, and I think that's what they were going for. It's not a huge budget, not a huge cast that anybody's heard of. Josh Hamilton plays Kayla's dad, single dad. I'll get to that in a few minutes as well with that portrait. But the film really aims to be realistic, and I think what it nails is her awkwardness, which we've seen on screen before. She's very awkward, doesn't have a lot of friends. She does like video blogs. She has her own videos, little tips she gives kids, but no one really watches them. Her views are very, very low. She tries to put herself out there, tries to talk more to people, gets invited to this birthday pool party by a girl who really doesn't want her to come. But the girl's mom forces her to invite her. That's a fascinating scene where she has to put a bathing suit on. And, you know, she doesn't have a perfect body. She's still, you know, kind of going through that formation of puberty. And so she's embarrassed to be at the pool party. And what's amazing about this film, Doug, is Elsie Fisher, there's no makeup on her. She's got acne. These massive close-ups we have of her in her bed playing with her phone, she's got acne. She slouches. She's awkward. Her body's not perfect.
She looks like an eighth grader.
She looks like an eighth grader. This is not some Disney princess perfect actress that we're watching. It's not even something like Edge of 17, which was a film that came out 2 years ago with Hailee Steinfeld. That was a good film, Doug, but by comparison, that film looks completely unrealistic because we're supposed to believe Hailee Steinfeld is unpopular and looks like Hailee Steinfeld. And she's a little too self-assured in the film. She's a little too funny. We don't get any of that with Elsie Fisher. Her conversations with other kids are awkward. There's a scene she has in the backseat of a car with an older boy that's so awkward to watch. Kind of this yin and yang back and forth. Nothing untoward happens, I must say that, so if parents are wondering. But in the scene, it doesn't. But it's so awkward that you really feel like you're watching something like you're spying on a teenager in real life. And that's what Burnham nails with this film. And he really also nails the obsession with technology. That really hasn't been portrayed on screen as effectively as this is. The Snapchat obsession, the YouTube obsession, the obsession with watching how-to videos, the phone obsession. And what he also gets is this point of a child's development where they start pushing their parents away. Mm-hmm. And you see that with her and her single dad, played by Josh Hamilton. And he can be doing nothing. And she'll say, why are you being weird? Why are you being quiet? Don't be weird and quiet at the same time. He can't do anything right. And believe me, I've been there. I have a 17 and a 10-year-old. And the obsession with technology, kind of this pushing of parents away with the 17-year-old specifically, you know, being snappy, being obnoxious, you know, you say something completely innocuous and they react completely differently. He nails that. Josh Hamilton, really good as the dad, single dad. Now, we get a single dad portrait in this film, which we don't always see on film. I won't, you know, tell viewers what's up with the mother. You'll have to go see the film. But it's really interesting, their relationship. He loves her so much. He's trying to connect with her. They do have a scene near the end of the film that really is touching and emotional that will, if you have kids or don't have kids, will probably get you emotional. So this is as realistic a teen movie as I've ever seen, Doug, and it's rated R. parents need to make that decision if they want their 14 or 15-year-old to go and they accompany them. I think it would be worth it. It's a soft R, in my opinion, but it really gives you a glimpse into the life of modern teenagers circa 2018.
I just think the idea is kind of brilliant because eighth grade, in my personal experience, was as memorable as any time I had in school. And I remember the first week more vividly than any other experience in school. This is about the last week. But there's so much change going on in your body, in your social life. It's just an amazing transformative period for most kids.
Yeah,
and I think most parents remember it.
And she's, you know, she's Elsie Fisher is so good in this part. I really hope the Oscar voters don't forget her. I don't know if she's going to be a big star as an adult. I don't know where she goes from here. I don't know if she's got movie star status. But this is as real and raw as you're going to get with acting. And she's so good. She's so awkward. I mean, the ability to perform an awkward scene, which isn't terribly melodramatic. It's like you're watching something real. You know, sometimes in movies, Doug, we get sort of a heightened sense of comedy, a heightened sense of unreality to make things funny or to make things interesting. That's not really the case here, and she just pulls it off perfectly.
Now, you're mentioning that it's getting multiple plays around here. So the audience is there for it.
I think the audience is there. What we don't know, Doug, is will the R rating keep the box office down? That's what we're not sure of. Also, is it a film teenagers want to go to? That's another question. Or would they rather go to the latest horror film?
Do they want to look in the mirror?
Do they want to look in the mirror and see a 95-minute film in which not a lot of stuff happens in the film? What happens is her life, her 1 week at the end of eighth grade as she struggles to move on to ninth grade, make new friends. I will say what's pretty cool in the film is when they do – they have this program where they connect her with a high school girl to kind of mentor them and they shadow them for a day. That's a great scene as well where she shadows this older girl who really takes to Kayla. She's nice to her. She thinks she's cool. So now all of a sudden this is a good thing for Kayla. She's connected with a girl who's in 10th or 11th grade that's really looking out for her and trying to help her. So that was a good thing I liked in the scene in the film as well. But, you know, what happens to Kayla beyond 8th grade, that's for the audience to kind of decide.
So you don't see any kind of a sequel here called 9th grade or 10th grade?
No, this is a standalone film. And I like I said, I really hope Oscar voters don't forget about this film because it's so much better than something like Edge of 17, which I liked, actually. I'm comparing it to that film because that's the most recent teen film I saw. But that film is unrealistic. When Hailee Steinfeld jokes with Woody Harrelson, who's her teacher, in kind of this unrealistic way, that's what eighth grade doesn't have. Eighth grade is it's technology obsessed, it's awkward, and it's brilliant. And Bo Burnham should really be credited with crafting a near masterpiece, I would say.
Well, I've seen only the trailer, and the trailer made me remember.
Yeah, nice to see a good single father portrait on film. We don't see that as much, so that was nice to see, and Josh Hamilton really plays the dad very well.
Well, this is one I look forward to seeing, so thanks for watching it and giving me that impetus. I've got a very, I think, simple Oscar trivia question because I was rushed today to find one. So here we go. Matt O'Lean, what was the last entirely black and white film to win Best Picture?
The Artist.
Okay, what year?
2011.
You got it. We've been to the movies with Matt O'Lean.
Remembering is a tricky, unstable business. I'm Jad Abumrad on the next Radiolab, How to Implant False Memories and Erase Real Ones.
Saturday at noon, 11 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 10th. North Dakota remembers World War I. When Dakota Territory was settled, the United States encouraged the arrival of European immigrants. At a federal court hearing this week in 1918, Judge Charles Amidon noted this in the sentencing of the Reverend John Fontana, pastor of the German Evangelical Lutheran Church of New Salem, who was convicted for violating the Espionage Act of 1917. The judge said, quote,
We urged you to come. We welcomed you. We gave you opportunity. We gave you land. We conferred on you the diadem of American citizenship. And then we went away and left you. We have paid almost no attention to what you were doing, unquote. But with the American Expeditionary Forces taking on increased frontline casualties, Judge Amidon went on to note that the World War had thrown up a powerful searchlight that found little Germanys, little Austrias, little Italys, little Norways, and little Russias. He argued that these immigrants had cherished the American soil, but they had thrown a circle around themselves, and instead of keeping their oath of allegiance to support the United States Constitution, they continued to cherish and perpetuate everything foreign. Reverend Fontana was sentenced to 3 years at the federal prison at Leavenworth. His offense is not very concrete, not buying war bonds, defending the attack on the Lusitania. Judge Amidon admonished him, stating, quote, "Your body has been in America, but your life has been in Germany. You have influenced others under your ministry to do the same thing. A good many Germans have been before me during this last month. They have lived in this country like yourself 10, 20, 30, 40 years. But as I looked at them, it was written all over every one of them, made in Germany. You promised you would bear true faith to the United States," Judge Amidon went on. "That meant that you would grow a new soul as soon as you could and put aside your German soul. It means that you will speak the American language, sing American songs, study American history, and open your eyes through every avenue to influence American life. It means you will begin, first of all, to learn English, the language of your country, so there will be windows and doors through which American ideals may enter," unquote. Judge Amidon felt the need to suppress the existence of these little islands of foreignness, dealing with them in a firm hand. The business of making foreignness perpetual had to cease, he said. If necessary, he declared they would cancel every certificate of naturalization in the United States. There was to be no more cherishing of foreign ideals. He reflected a common attitude of the times, that the day had arrived when every immigrant needed to grow an American soul. Today's Dakota Daybook, written by Jim Davis. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Should Republicans panic after Tuesday's primaries, or Democrats? We'll look at this week's election results to see if there's a blue or red tint to the wave that takes us to November's midterm elections. Also, Charlottesville, a year later, through the eyes of a local reporter, she says events of a year ago made residents feel they just don't want to be bystanders to history. Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Monday on Main Street, True North Theater Company of Bismarck was founded last year in the historic High Prairie Arts Building. The upcoming show is Grinder's Stand, a fictional dramatization of the last weeks in the life of Meriwether Lewis. We'll hear more about True North and the current play from Artistic Director John Climo. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday, and we hope you'll check out Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.